KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says he is not joking about the possibility of running for a third term. That's not possible under the Constitution, and the president won't say what he's planning. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. RFK Jr. is cutting Health and Human Services staff and closing offices around the country. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We speak to a former HHS secretary who tells us why she turned down a dramatic reorganization plan during her tenure. Also, Wisconsin's Supreme Court race is the most expensive judicial election ever, and a new National Medal of Honor Museum in Texas tells the stories of war heroes. It's Monday, March 31st, which is the day back in 1918 that we started losing that hour of sleep, the start of daylight saving time. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The military-led government in Myanmar says more than 1,700 people have been killed by the mammoth earthquake that hit the country last Friday. Information is scarce. The quake's epicenter was near the huge city of Mandalay, Myanmar's second largest city. Michael Sullivan reports in neighboring Thailand that pictures coming out of Mandalay are awful.
And those pictures show many parts of the city of 1.5 million in ruins. And efforts to free those trapped under the rubble have been hampered by a lack of heavy equipment and personnel. And time is running short for finding more survivors, especially with the temperature hovering near 100 degrees. And the smell of death, rescue workers say, is overpowering.
Michael Sullivan reporting. The quake also caused damage in Thailand, hundreds of miles away. At least 18 people there have been killed. Health officials in Gaza report that Israeli strikes have killed more than 85 Palestinians since the beginning of the Muslim holiday of Eid. That began yesterday, marking the end of Ramadan. While families typically celebrate the holiday, NPR's Anas Baba reports from Gaza instead, many parents were burying their children.
In a series of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza Strip last night, which occurred in the first day of the Muslims' holiday Eid, at least one entire family was killed, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Health officials say the victims included both parents and three children, aged between 3 and 8 years old. The Israeli military also ordered all Palestinians to evacuate the southern city of Rafah, as it expanded its military ground incursion there. The operation has so far led to the displacement of about 40,000 Palestinians, according to the Rafah municipality. This comes as the United Nations said it has helped recover the bodies for more than a dozen emergency responders killed by the Israeli military fire. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
President Trump says he is not joking about potentially serving a third term in the White House. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the 22nd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution says no one can be elected more than twice to the office of the presidency.
Trump told NBC's Kristen Welker that there are, quote, methods that could allow him to serve another term. Pressed on Air Force One, Trump said it's a long way off.
You know, we have almost 4 years to go, and that's a long time. But despite that, so many people are saying, you've got to run again. They love the job we're doing. Most importantly, they love the job we're doing.
In an average of polls, Trump's approval rating is under 50%, but still better than he's seen before. Asked directly whether he's planning to leave office on January 20th, 2029, or if he's saying he might not, Trump declined to answer. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks are mixed. The Dow's up 24 points. The Nasdaq is down 300. This is NPR. The chair of the Democratic National Committee campaigned in Florida this weekend. There are two special congressional elections there tomorrow. From member station WFSU, Tristan Wood reports, Chair Ken Martin is pointing to one congressional race in particular.
Martin was on the ground campaigning for Josh Wheel, the Democratic candidate in Florida's 6th congressional district, running against Republican State Senator Randy Fine. The seat went to the GOP in 2024 by 30-plus points, but national Democrats seeking to reduce President Trump's power in Congress have donated over $10 million to Wheel. That's why Martin says it's important to challenge every race.
The DNC is not going to leave any race uncontested or left behind.
National Democrats have reduced investments in the state as it has gotten redder. It went to President Trump by 13 points in 2024. the largest presidential margin of victory in Florida since 1988. For NPR News, I'm Tristan Wood in Tallahassee.
A court in France has convicted the leader of France's far-right party, the National Rally, of embezzling money from European Union funds. The French court sentenced Marie Le Pen to 4 years in prison with 2 years suspended. She cannot run for public office for the next 5 years. SpaceX is scheduled to launch a private crewed mission from Cape Canaveral later today. The Fram-2 mission is a little different. It will be the first human space flight to circle the Earth's two poles. The team is being led by cryptocurrency investor Chun Wang. He paid SpaceX an undisclosed sum to lead the private mission. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Department of Health and Human Services is set to lose about a quarter of its workforce under an overhaul planned by the Trump administration. We speak with a former head of the agency about what this could mean.
First, could President Trump get elected to a third term in office? The Constitution says no.
But President Trump has declined to rule out the possibility of serving a third term. Yesterday, Trump told NBC News' Kristen Welker in a phone call that he is, quote, not joking about staying on as president, and said there are ways he could, although he did not elaborate.
Joining us to talk about all this is NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who was traveling with the president this weekend. Good morning, Tam.
Good morning.
So Trump has talked about serving a third term many times. I think people assumed he was joking, and based on the plain language of the 22nd Amendment, that would not be constitutional. So what's going on here?
You know, the way he talks about a third term, it's like he's keeping his options open. On Air Force One, I asked him about what he told NBC and asked if that means he's not planning to leave office. And here's what he said.
I'm not looking at that, but I'll tell you, I have had more people ask me to have a third term.
Later, I asked him again to clarify, are you planning to leave office on January 20th, 2029, or are you saying you might not? And he looked to the other reporters and said, any other questions? He also said it is still quite early to be having these conversations. And as you say, the 22nd Amendment bars a president from being elected to a third term. But there are some novel legal theories that have been floated. And while they are quite far-fetched, the fact that Trump isn't dismissing it out of hand means it can't be ignored.
Is there support for a third Trump term, as he says?
Trump's approval rating is underwater right now, but these are better poll numbers than he's seen before, and there is something of a movement among his most ardent supporters to promote the idea of a third term. Earlier this month, Steve Bannon, who served in Trump's first White House and is now an influential podcaster, said that he not only thinks Trump should run, but that he'd win. Separately, just 3 days into Trump's second term, a Republican congressman introduced a constitutional amendment to pave the way for a third Trump term. But just to go back to the Constitution, there are actually two amendments that would stand in his way. The 22nd Amendment is one of those. It was put in place after FDR served four terms. Separately, the 12th Amendment prevents anyone disqualified constitutionally from being the president from being the vice president.
Is there a political reason for Trump to be saying this?
Yeah, you know, he's in his second and final term, unless something dramatic happens. And that means the clock is ticking on his power and relevance, because soon members of his own party will be running to replace him, and he will be seen as a lame duck. So teasing a third term has the potential, at least, to extend his influence.
Before we let you go, in his conversation with NBC's Kristen Welker, Trump also made news on tariffs. Tell us what he said there, please.
Yeah, he stood firm on the 25% tariffs on foreign automobile imports, including parts made outside of the U.S. He dismissed concerns that this could cause prices to rise for American consumers. He said, quote, "I couldn't care less, because if the prices on foreign cars go up, they're going to buy American cars." But even cars assembled in the U.S. often contain parts made in other countries. The president is promising additional tariffs later this week. He is calling Wednesday Liberation Day. Economists warn higher tariffs mean increased costs for consumers, and polls show that voters just want the president to focus on bringing costs down.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Tam, thank you.
You're welcome.
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. plans to dramatically transform the Department of Health and Human Services. He is aiming to lay off some 10,000 workers, eliminate departments, and close regional offices. Another 10,000 employees have already left their jobs. So if this plan goes forward, it would represent a cut of about a quarter of the agency's staff. To understand what these changes could mean, we've called Donna Shalala. She headed HHS under President Bill Clinton from 1993 to 2001, and she is with us now. Oh, good morning, Madam Secretary. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
I want to begin with a video that Secretary Kennedy shared on Elon Musk's social media platform X about his plans. Here it is.
We're going to eliminate an entire alphabet soup of departments and agencies while preserving their core functions by merging them into a new organization called the Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA.
I understand that you were approached with a proposal to reorganize the department when you headed the agency. Now, it was not the same as this plan, but in a recent op-ed, you wrote about why you rejected it. Could you just briefly tell us why?
Well, because it slows down your ability to get improvements in the department. I'm not into structural reform, and it just takes up so much time. It unsettles the people that you need to work, and they've combined this structure, which doesn't make a lot of sense, with firing people. You can't fire the lead people for infectious diseases while you've got a measles outbreak. You can't fire 1,000 people at the FDA when you want to protect new vaccines, medical devices. It just makes no sense what they're doing. And they don't understand the department and its programs well enough to do these kinds of changes. So cutting a quarter of the workforce, it makes no sense. And it's probably dangerous for the future.
Well, let me dig into that in a minute. But one of the things you said in your op-ed is that you advised this colleague who presented this plan, unless it was data and outcome driven, that it was a waste of time. Do you think that this reorganization plan as presented by the current secretary is data and outcome driven?
There's no evidence that it is.
So, and when you say this would be dangerous, can you say more about that? Why?
Well, because willy-nilly firing people and trying to do reorganization and slowing down the decision-making in the department, its ability to manage something like the measles outbreak and other outbreaks that are to come, slowing down the progress that FDA will make on the approval of drugs, slowing down and eliminating what drives our economy, and that is the scientific research and our deep investments in the NIH, is going backwards, not forwards.
The secretary argues that the agency's core functions will still be performed, but this just eliminates bureaucratic overlay. Could that be true?
No.
And
there's not a chance. What he calls bureaucratic overlay is actually the leadership of different programs.
So the top vaccine official of the Food and Drug Administration, Peter Marks, has resigned. He cited Secretary Kennedy's, quote, misinformation and lies as the reason for his departure. Now, people resign for policy differences before in other administrations. Is there something about this that you find noteworthy?
Yes, it's fundamental. And he's basically saying the opposite of what people in Congress on the Republican side are saying. He said, he's basically saying Robert Kennedy Jr., the secretary, is not committed to vaccines, particularly vaccines for children.
And how is that different from, I'm thinking during the Clinton administration, I'm thinking about Peter Edelman, who resigned over the administration's direction on welfare policy. Is there something different than that? People resign when they disagree with the direction of the administration. Is there something fundamentally different about this?
Absolutely, because when Peter resigned, this was not about people dying. It was about a difference in how you would administer the welfare program for this country. It turned out to be pretty successful during that time. But in this case, it's about science. It's about whether you believe in childhood vaccines or you don't believe in childhood vaccines, and whether children are going to get ill because you're sending mixed messages to parents all over the country. The anti-vax movement has resulted in children that should not be getting sick, getting sick.
You know, I'm going to ask you to put on your member of Congress hat now, because you've had a long and varied career. I mentioned that you're a secretary of an agency, you're an assistant secretary at HUD, you've also been a university president, and you know, you've taught in public health. So you've had a long and varied career, but you're also a member of Congress. One of the arguments that people are making here is that the Democrats have not done a good job of explaining why these cuts matter to the American people. Do you think that that might be true?
I don't think it's completely true, because I see it at the local level. Once you get out of Washington, you see members of Congress explaining to their communities what the impact of these cuts are. And by the way, if you live in New Mexico or in Texas and you see the measles outbreak, if you're getting Social Security and you find out that you can't go to your local office because they're closing it, you see the impacts. So over the next few months, Americans are going to see the impacts of what I believe are irresponsible cuts in government programs and in our ability to deliver successfully to help people stay healthy and to improve their welfare.
So what should your fellow people who are concerned as you are should be doing right now, particularly people in leadership? What should they be doing?
They should be talking to their members of Congress and their senators. They should be talking to them about how they feel these cuts are irresponsible, that they're dangerous to our health. And by the way, the business community needs to step up. If I was Big Pharma, if I represented the pharmaceutical companies, I'd be concerned with Peter Marks leaving and 1,000 people being cut from the FDA. Okay. What does that say about investors who have fueled our economy with these deep investments in bioscience and in our pharmaceutical industry?
We have to leave it there. That is Donna Shalala, former Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services under President Bill Clinton. Madam Secretary, thank you for joining us. And I do want to say here that NPR has invited Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for an interview several times since his confirmation as HHS Secretary. His office has declined our request so far, but our invitation still stands. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, British actor Stephen Graham, who's starring in two new shows. In the Hulu series A Thousand Blows, he plays a real-life bare-knuckle boxer fighting in Victorian London. And in Netflix's Adolescence, he plays the father of a 13-year-old boy arrested for murdering a classmate. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Supreme Court hears a case today about whether charities run by religious groups have to pay unemployment taxes that cover their employees. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Ironically, today's case comes from Wisconsin, which in 1932, at the height of the Depression, became the first state in the nation to set up an unemployment compensation program. The experiment failed, largely because paying into the fund was optional and employers dropped out, often to undercut their competitors. But 3 years later, Congress enacted a federal state unemployment system that required all employers, including nonprofits, to pay into the system so that employees who lose their jobs can pay their basic bills. The only exemptions were for religious employers who conduct programs that are, quote, operated primarily for religious purposes. Today's case was brought by a single chapter of Catholic Charities affiliated with the Diocese of Superior in northern Wisconsin. The chapter contends that it's entitled to be exempted from the state's mandatory unemployment compensation system because it's a charitable organization that carries out a religious mission. At the same time, however, Catholic Charities specifically eschews indoctrination. There's no proselytizing permitted, and employees include Catholics and non-Catholics alike.
I don't think it detracts from the fact that this is part of a religious mission.
Eric Rosbach represents Catholic Charities.
The Catholic Church tells people you're supposed to help other people.
But is that enough to qualify for an exemption from a compulsory state compensation system? The state of Wisconsin says it is not, noting that other nonprofits, and indeed even other Catholic Charities chapters, do not seek religious exemptions, even though they, too, are run by the diocese they serve. The state declined to provide anyone for an interview about today's case, but in its brief it contends that the work that Catholic Charities does is, quote, typical of the work done by other nonprofits, and that without a religious gloss on the actual services that are provided by the charity, it's just like any other nonprofit that must pay into the state system. Rosbach, however, counters that forcing Catholic Charities to participate interferes with the church's free exercise of religion, and that it unconstitutionally entangles church and state. He sees the mandatory system as perverse because under the state's rationale, Catholic Charities could opt out of the system if it proselytized or employed only Catholics, but it cannot opt out when it acts as the charitable arm of a diocese. So why does this branch of Catholic Charities want to opt out of the state program? It wants to join something called the Church Unemployment Pay Program, known as CUP, which provides unemployment compensation for employees at churches, Catholic schools, and other overtly religious church affiliates. Again, lawyer Rosbach.
We think this will definitely save us some money. You know, it will save them money that they can then use to carry out the rest of their mission.
Our concern is that you get what you pay for.
Lawrence Dupuy filed a brief in the case on behalf of the Economic Policy Institute, siding with the state of Wisconsin.
In fact, the CUP program disclaims any responsibility if the employer doesn't have sufficient reserves set aside. And you'd lose all the federal add-ons that go along with this and that are especially important during deep downturns.
As a practical matter, Dupuis says he doesn't see CUP as equivalent to the state unemployment compensation program. And he warns that if the Supreme Court allows Catholic Charities of Superior to opt out, there will be no stopping point for other organizations.
Catholic hospitals alone employ 500,000 people, and we estimate 1.2 million people employed by religiously affiliated nonprofits.
If all of these Catholic hospitals and religious employers were to opt out of the state insurance systems, he says it would put a genuine strain on the system's viability, a strain that could be felt in 46 other states that have religious exemption laws similar to Wisconsin's. Notwithstanding all that, the state of Wisconsin is likely playing a weak hand at the Supreme Court. Catholic Charities is a revered organization that does everything from providing aid to the needy to aiding the resettlement of refugees. The Supreme Court's conservative supermajority has repeatedly sided with the church's position in religion cases, and 7 of the 9 justices were raised Catholic. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
The doors are now open at the new National Medal of Honor Museum in Arlington, Texas.
The Medal of Honor is the highest military decoration in the U.S. for valor on the battlefield. The museum's mission, according to CEO and President Chris Cassidy, is to inspire.
We're going to do that through the stories of Medal of Honor recipients and the values that the medal has, such as courage, sacrifice, commitment, service over self, service to others, and patriotism, citizenship. All those kind of things are embedded in the DNA of the medal.
Cassidy is also a veteran.
I was in the Navy for 28 years, 11 of those in the SEAL teams, and 17 as a NASA astronaut down at the Johnson Space Center in Houston and flew in space 3 different times.
The National Medal of Honor was first awarded in the Civil War, and since then, about 3,500 service members have earned it. Only 61 are alive today.
The museum is backed by high-profile donors like Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones. The names of medal recipients are engraved around a rotunda called the Ring of Valor, and photos of the recipients cover the museum's walls.
Among them is Captain William Swenson, who was serving in Afghanistan in 2009 when his unit was ambushed. Swenson risked his life to carry the wounded to safety.
Obviously, I was called to serve at a very high level. Sometimes that's what happens in military service, and that was a reaction in 2009, and the order is 2013.
The firefight claimed the lives of 5 Americans and 10 Afghan Army troops.
The museum's opening, Swenson says, was an incredible experience for him.
One of the things that comes with this award is the understanding that you don't wear it for yourself, you wear it for others. You wear it for your teammates who were there at the battle, but you ultimately wear it for the service members who, if they were called upon to do the same thing I did, they would as well.
Ultimately, he says, the museum represents American values.
When you go inside, when you see this physical structure and you look at these stories and you think to yourself, this is history, it's not so much history as it is vignettes of what everyday Americans did on behalf of their comrades.
Even though Swenson says the museum can't fully capture the service and sacrifice, it is a place where their stories can be told. This is NPR News.
A Biden-era program allowing more than 200,000 Ukrainians to come to the U.S. was halted by President Trump. Now, thousands of Ukrainians in the U.S. face an uncertain future.
Ukrainians, we cannot create any plans for our lives because of this situation. Like, we cannot live full life.
Planning for a future on pause. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. 25% tariffs on imports of cars and car parts take effect this week. President Trump has said he could not care less if prices on foreign cars increase because he says Americans will then choose to buy more U.S.-made vehicles. Economist Diane Swonk says U.S. automakers may not increase production right away because of the uncertainty surrounding tariffs.
They can literally change with, you know, a pen stroke. Because of that, there's no certainty on how long they'll actually last.
A French court has found far-right leader Marine Le Pen guilty of embezzlement and sentenced her to 4 years in prison, two suspended. Le Pen is now banned from running for public office for 5 years, upending a 2027 presidential run. Sorbonne University professor Sylvain Bremaud, an editor of AOC Media, describes the impact of today's decision.
Well, it's a very strong blow, not just against Marine Le Pen, but there were 25 people involved, and also the political party itself has been found guilty. And so it's a lot of people that were actually banned from running in all kinds of elections in France, either national or local elections.
Marine Le Pen reportedly left the courtroom abruptly before her sentence was announced. The far-right leader has vowed to appeal. The Dow is up 24 points. The Nasdaq is down 289 points. This is NPR News. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the work of ending the war between Russia and Ukraine is a, quote, drawn-out process. Peskov did not directly reference President Trump's latest frustration with Russia. Trump had said one of his priorities would be to stop the more than three-year-old war between Russia and Ukraine. Both sides reported the continuation of cross-border attacks today. The Final Four is set for the NCAA men's basketball tournament. Auburn won its regional final with a 70-64 victory yesterday over Michigan State. Greg Eklund has a recap.
The Auburn Tigers got a second-half scare when their leading scorer, Janai Broome, injured his arm and went to the locker room.
The doc said, you know, nothing's wrong, you're good, you know, nothing serious. So at that moment, you know, I just want to help my teammates.
He did, with a key three-point basket down the stretch and finished with 25 points. Auburn's win means all four number one seeds in the tournament are heading to the Final Four. The other three are Florida, Duke, and Houston. For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund.
In women's, two teams are headed for the Final Four. South Carolina hoping to repeat their victory from last year. The other's UCLA, whose women's team is making their first Final Four appearance. The other teams for the women's Final Four will be set after two more Elite Eight games tonight. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. An election in Wisconsin tomorrow is the most expensive judicial race in American history. As Wisconsin Public Radio's Anya Van Wagtingdong reports, the contest is being fueled by out-of-state billionaires.
By the time I finish reading this sentence, the total tally has probably changed, so I'll just say a lot of money is funneling into Wisconsin, like close to $100 million a lot. Donors are backing either Dane County Judge Susan Crawford.
I'm Susan Crawford, and looking out for people is why I became a prosecutor and a judge.
Or Waukesha County Judge Brad Schimmel.
I'm Brad Schimmel, and justice is my life's work.
She's liberal, he's conservative. Whoever wins will determine the ideological majority on the nonpartisan Wisconsin Supreme Court, with issues like abortion, voting, and labor law at stake. They're both getting plenty of small donations, but in Wisconsin, state parties can receive unlimited donations and spend that money with no caps. And in this race, a handful of out-of-state billionaires are really taking advantage of that.
Thanks for coming. What do you think of my hat?
Top of that list is Elon Musk. That's him last night at a rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, wearing a Packers cheese head. And he spelled out what he says are the stakes when it comes to electing Schimmel.
I feel like this is one of those things that may not seem that it's going to affect the entire destiny of humanity, but I think it will.
Musk personally gave millions to the Wisconsin Republican Party, and two of his spending groups have given at least $17 million supporting Schimmel. They've produced ads arguing Schimmel will support President Donald Trump's agenda. Susan Crawford, again his opponent, has argued that means Schimmel is bought and sold by Musk.
He has basically taken over Brad Schimmel's campaign.
As for her campaign, a big spender is the liberal megadonor George Soros. He's given $2 million to the Wisconsin Democratic Party. So, of course, Schimmel has fired back that Soros, a boogeyman of the right, is controlling Crawford.
He's a dangerous person to have an endorsement from.
Crawford also has support from Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. He's a hotel's heir who self-financed his own campaigns. He's also given Wisconsin Democrats $1.5 million to support Crawford. Pritzker has supported Wisconsin politics before, like when he rallied Democrats at the state party convention in Milwaukee ahead of last year's presidential race.
We will be Midwest nice to you while we Midwest beat you.
Two other Illinois billionaires are looking north to Wisconsin. That's Richard and Elizabeth Uline. If you've ever seen a Uline cardboard box or truck, that's their company. All told, they've spent about $8 million supporting Schimmel.
Besides being shocked at spending that much money on a Wisconsin Supreme Court race, I'm also very distressed.
That's the way former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske describes watching the fundraising hit the stratosphere. She sat on the bench in the mid-90s and...
My race so long ago was totally $250,000.
And she says she's worried about what all this money means for judicial fairness.
I think what's happening is just a nightmare and really going to the heart of our independence as that third branch of government.
Geske and other retired judges once asked the court to change its rules to require recusal in cases involving campaign donors. The court's then conservative majority declined. They said it would chill free speech. So, donors could easily see their interests go before the court. That means Crawford and Schimmel have a line to walk, each arguing that the other is beholden to special interests while accepting big checks of their own. For NPR News, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
President Trump has issued an executive order to try to make changes at the Smithsonian Institution.
The Smithsonian is the world's largest museum, education, and research complex, and it's comprised of 21 museums and libraries each, 14 education centers, and the National Zoo. The order also paves the way for the return of monuments that have been removed in recent years.
NPR culture reporter Isabella Gomez Sarmiento is with us now for more. Good morning, Isabella.
Good morning.
So the order is called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. Maybe start by telling us a bit more about what it says.
A lot of this is about the people and stories that are highlighted at these museums and sites and the language used to describe American history. The order directs Vice President J.D. Vance, who is on the Smithsonian's Board of Regents, to oversee the removal of, quote, improper, divisive, or anti-American ideology from the Smithsonian's museums and research centers. Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie Bunch sent an email on Friday telling staff that the Smithsonian will continue to employ internal review processes and that, quote, as always, our work will be shaped by the best scholarship, free of partisanship, to help the American public better understand the nation's history, challenges, and triumphs. The Smithsonian spokesperson confirmed that email to NPR, and we should note here Lonnie Bunch was previously the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, one of the museums Trump singled out in the executive order.
There's also a section of the executive order focused on monuments. What does that say?
That's right. I mean, if we can rewind a little bit, there's been a growing movement in recent years to reflect on what history we honor in the U.S. and what may have been left out. But there was a turning point when a white police officer killed George Floyd, who was black, in 2020. His death sparked wide protests, and for a lot of people, it was a reexamining of this country's racial history. Within a year and a half, 200 public Confederate symbols had been taken down, relocated, or renamed. That included things like monuments, school names, even road names. Those are numbers provided by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is a legal and advocacy group, which tracks Confederate iconography in the U.S. I should say, the executive order isn't specifically about Confederate symbols, but it instructs the Interior Secretary to review monuments, markers, and statues that may have been taken down or changed since January 2020, more than a year before Trump left office in his first term, and restore them. It calls for a wholesale review to make sure that memorials under Interior Department jurisdiction, quote, do not contain descriptions, depictions, or other content that inappropriately disparage Americans past or living, including persons living in colonial times.
Do we know what monuments could actually be put back up?
That's the big question, and it's pretty unclear right now. Seth Levy of the Southern Poverty Law Center says many of the sites that did see changes were on land controlled by municipalities and state governments, not land controlled by the Department of the Interior or any of the bureaus it oversees, like the National Park Service.
I'm not actually aware of any removals on National Park Service land.
We reached out to the Department of the Interior and didn't hear back.
So, you know, a lot of this executive order focuses on how the story of America is told. So what are historians saying about this?
That's right. I spoke with art historian Erin Thompson. She's the author of a book called Smashing Statues, The Rise and Fall of America's Public Monuments. And she says that Trump's executive order is trying to gloss over some of the darker aspects of American history.
But you can't turn an ugly history into a glorious one unless you're not telling the truth.
Thompson says it's important to grapple with mistakes from the past so we don't make them again. But ultimately, you can't control historical memory by controlling monuments.
That's NPR culture reporter Isabella Gomez Sarmiento. Isabella, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd's new book is a collection of interviews with the notorious Paul Newman, Tina Fey, Elon Musk. Next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, me Martinez. Black rhinos are endangered. In South Africa, they get moved around to protect against poaching, but since they're 3,000 pounds, the safest way is by helicopter and upside down. Tranquilizers lower their oxygen levels, but upside down, their spines straighten out, which helps them breathe. And their horns act like a bird's tail feather, keeping them steady, even aerodynamic. When they wake up, I wonder if they wonder, how did I get here? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Maybe you're still smarting over your March Madness fails or celebrating your wins, and maybe you put some money on it. If you did, you wouldn't be alone. Americans were expected to bet $3 billion on the tournament this year alone. But when does sports betting become a problem? NPR's Kadia Riddle has this report.
To be clear, most people who gamble enjoy it responsibly, but not everyone. This man's name is Scott. He's a lifelong sports fan and a high school coach. He says people like him have a hard time disentangling gambling from their passion for sports.
Because it's something that we love.
March Madness, he says, is extra difficult.
Everyone I know that gambles just goes crazy this time of year, from the conference tournaments through the national championship game.
Scott asked that NPR just use his first name for this story. He's been in recovery for a few months. He says he's not ready to face the stigma around problem gambling that he would encounter if he talked about it publicly.
It feels like a character defect. It feels like I'd be admitting to being stupid.
A lot more people are legally gambling in recent years. Sports betting is now legal in roughly two-thirds of the country. Some online gambling platforms also have casino games like blackjack and roulette. Michelle Malkin is the director of the Gambling Research and Policy Initiative at East Carolina University. She says unlike drugs and alcohol, many people don't know the signs of gambling addiction.
It usually starts with like somebody's really preoccupied with gambling. They want to go gamble by themselves, whether at home or if they do gambling like at a casino, but they don't tend to do it as a social activity anymore.
These behaviors can trigger the same neural pathways as substance use disorders.
Like they might try to stop, but they just can't seem to stay stopped for very long.
Gambling disorders can lead to tragedy, failed relationships and careers, even suicide. Malkin calls it the gambler's fallacy.
That to fix these problems that have been caused by gambling, I just need to gamble more. And it becomes cyclical because then they are digging the hole deeper and deeper.
There are some outpatient therapists who specialize in gambling addiction. There are also a small number of programs around the country that do inpatient treatment. Many people say the first step, find a support group. Here's Scott.
You have to find connections. You have to find human connections.
Gamblers Anonymous is an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous, but not every place in the U.S. has a meeting. Scott says he had to look to online message boards, places like Reddit, to find people struggling with the same problem.
Even if it's one person at the beginning.
Jeffrey Wasserman runs an online support group for people struggling with gambling. He says quitting sports betting is especially difficult.
So now you're asking me to give up the two things in life that I love the most, and that is gambling and sports.
He compares it to an eating disorder. Just like learning to be around food, people can learn to be around sports. He says, start small. For example, try a week-long break or record a game so you're not tempted to bet on the results.
Like anything else, you can approach it in a measured way.
A measured way to get back to a love of the game without the risk of losing everything. Kadia Riddle, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQuil.com.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Today is the third year anniversary of the liberation of Bucha, a suburb north of Kyiv. It was under Russian occupation for a month right after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 2022. Ukraine has asked for the destruction there to be investigated as a crime against humanity. Russia denies it committed war crimes. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is in Bucha. Eleanor, remind us what happened there.
Yeah, well, the Russian army arrived here just a few days after the invasion. They were coming from the north, but they got bogged down and ended up staying in Bucha for 33 days. Their headquarters was a school here. And when they were finally pushed out, the world discovered the carnage through physical evidence and the stories of those who'd survived. More than 400 civilians were killed. People were shot at point-blank range in the street and left to rot. Old men were shot off their bicycles. People were held in basements for weeks. Many were tortured. And a mass grave was found on the church grounds. You might remember some of the pictures of that one street that was completely destroyed with the burned-out Russian tanks and also the dead bodies just lying in the streets for weeks. It completely shocked Ukrainians and the world, frankly, and it became a kind of moral turning point for this war. Of course, as you said, Russia has always denied it. They say fake videos were created of the whole thing.
So what's it like today, and how are they marking this liberation?
Well, we've driven up here. It's about 25 miles northwest of Kyiv. It's a very nice suburb, well off, you know, surrounded by pine forests, and everything that was destroyed has been rebuilt. And while there are no real signs of physically what happened, the mental wounds are still deep. There's a wall of names of those killed on the church ground, and they're planning a much bigger memorial project. It will be kind of a memory space to tell the story of the 33 days of occupation, not through numbers and dates, but through an interactive experience where visitors will go down into a tunnel and then emerge again into the light. And today, President Zelensky is supposed to participate in a ceremony this afternoon with some of the soldiers who helped liberate this town.
Eleanor, what are the residents of Bucha telling you?
Well, I spoke with 43-year-old Dmitro, who actually came here 3 years ago from Mariupol, the Ukrainian city on the Black Sea that was besieged and destroyed by Russia in the first weeks of the war. He preferred not to give his last name because he may be conscripted into the army. He told me he wished President Trump would come here himself with his staff to see what happened and to see how we live, he said.
It's Ukraine. It's not Russia. It's not part of some Russian colony. We are a different nation, we are different people, we have different goals, we have different values.
And you know, I asked him, A, what are those values? And he had one word.
Freedom is the most, freedom, freedom, and freedom.
So, you know, many Ukrainians told me 3 years on, as war fatigue sets in, the world really needs to be reminded of what happened here and to remember that Ukraine is not just fighting for its territory, it's fighting for its identity, its very existence, and fighting to prevent atrocities like what happened in Bucha.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Bucha, Ukraine. Eleanor, thanks.
You're welcome, A.
Nonviolent protests against Tesla and its CEO Elon Musk continued over the weekend. The Tesla takedown movement is urging people to sell their Tesla cars in stock. Protesters are upset with Musk and his role heading DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, which has led aggressive cuts across the federal government. Tesla sales are down in Europe and in China, and many analysts say the brand is in trouble.
It's not just the political thing. That's just the icing on the cake. It's his lack of focus and interest in a car company, which has been demonstrated by lack of innovation, and his attention going everywhere but the car company.
That's Alan Adamson. He's worked as a brand and marketing consultant for more than 30 years.
Whenever a business fails, it's never about one thing. It's usually about many things. So the brand problems now are, his DOGE issue, his Cybertruck recall, lots of things. But it's never just one thing. It's having a cumulative effect, and it's reached the tipping point.
Now, have there been other examples that you could point to in the past where something that a CEO has said or done affected their company sales?
Not in the car industry, for sure. You know, there are smaller examples, but nothing at this scale.
Alan, what is it, though, about cars that make it such a different market than other products? I mean, is it one of those things where when you buy a car, it says something about you without saying anything at all necessarily?
Yeah, most people think, you know, they buy the car, they give a rationale. I bought the car because it has good acceleration. I like the way it steers. But when you look at car performance, there's no difference between cars. They all get roughly the same mileage, either electric or gas.
They all roll, right? They all roll on the road.
Right. You look inside, they all hook up to your smartphone. In fact, when you get in many cars, and if you don't look at the brand, you have no idea what car you're in. And so cars are what we call badge brands. They are identity signals. They say, I'm driving a BMW. I'm driving a Ford pickup truck, because it says something about you. It's more like a beer brand and a fashion brand. You park it in a driveway to say, look at me, I'm a green person, I'm driving a Tesla, or look at me, I'm a real macho person, I'm driving this big pickup truck. And so cars are always about the brand image. And once the brand image is not something you want to say to your neighbors, you're in big trouble in a category that's brand driven.
But would it be easy if, say, for some reason, somehow he divests in Tesla, sells every bit of stock and ownership stake that he has in Tesla, and then all of a sudden has nothing to do with the brand?
That would be probably the best thing for the brand. That's the only easy fix, which is I'm selling it. I'm going to focus, you know, other things I'm interested in. And the new ownership team is going to keep their eye on the ball, because I think the issue is focus. If you're building a car that has your life at stake when you drive it, you don't want a brand perception that people at the company are moving fast and breaking things. You want somebody you can trust to say, when I get in this car, the wheels aren't going to fall off, or I'm not going to get killed. So having this sort of erratic personality is probably a more damaging brand attribute than helping the government try to save money on federal employees.
So I think the lesson, Alan, here is for any current CEO or aspiring CEO is maybe don't ever talk politics publicly.
That's always been the lesson. And now the more polarized the country is, the more true it is. And it will be a good lesson for other CEOs to say, look, as much as my employees want me to speak out or I want to speak out, less is more.
That's Alan Adamson. He's the CEO and co-founder of the brand and marketing consultancy Metaforce. Alan, thanks a lot.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Musk told Fox News last week, quote, Tesla is a peaceful company that has made great cars and said it hasn't harmed anyone. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Edmund Yates has been a little incoherent.
in consequence of the excellent dinner and good wine that he has drunk. Therefore, I beg you will excuse him. He has his lucid interval. For myself, I can only say that I am astonished and somewhat terrified at the result of this evening's experiment. Astonished at the one.